Hi, I'm David Fettis, and welcome to this third segment on religion. We're going to look at various theories of religion. Many early sociological theorists proposed theories attempting to explain religion. In addition to these classical approaches to understanding religion, one recent explanation for the continued high levels of religiosity will be proposed, along with a social-psychological explanation that will attempt to explain the continuing attraction of religion. Just keep in mind what we've said before, that not all sociologists are believers in God. In fact, most have not been. And so they do look for other explanations, but it is true that many, many people are drawn to religion even when they aren't drawn to the true God. So there is much merit in considering just some of the sociological reasons why people would be drawn to religion. These theories approach religion from different perspectives. They try to explain the function of religion in society, or the role of religion in the life of the individual, or the nature and origin of religion. Here's some theories we'll look at: the structural functional, the social conflict theory, social constructionist theory, religious pluralism, and social psychological. Emile Durkheim originated the structural functional theory. He said that religion is, in a sense, the celebration and even self-worship of human society. And given this approach, Durkheim proposed that religion has three major functions in society. Social cohesion. It maintains social solidarity through shared rituals and beliefs. If people do the same rituals, it helps them to stick together better. Social control is a second function. Religious morals and norms support conformity and control in society. Religion can also legitimize a political system. And third, it gives meaning and purpose. Religion provides answers to existential questions, which has an overlap with the social psychological. At any rate, Durkheim said this was very important for society, for it to stick together, for the authorities in society to have some control of things, for people to have a sense of meaning and purpose. And so the values of a society were kind of projected onto a cosmic screen, and that was what they considered worthy of worship. But really, it was just helping them to function as a society. And Durkheim said he respected that. Societies need to function, and religions help them to do that. The primary criticism of the structural functional approach to religion is that it overlooks religion's dysfunctions. Well, that's the primary criticism if you don't happen to believe in any of them. But anyway, for instance, religion can be used to justify terrorism and violence. Religion has been the justification and motivation for war. So it certainly serves other functions. It serves to legitimate wars and attacks and violence and so on. Some religions have done that. And so that is one criticism, but that's not really a criticism. Some societies want to do that, and so their religion helps them do that, and that's a social function of their religion. And so the theory, or the definition almost, might be somewhat accurate for why that religion does that. It causes society to function better in some respects, but maybe to function worse in other respects if it's a bad religion. A bad religion will help to produce a bad society. A bad society will come up with a bad religion. The social conflict approach, second explanation, is rooted in Marx's analysis of capitalism. According to Marx, religion plays a significant role in maintaining the status quo. Marx claimed that religion was a tool of the bourgeoisie to keep the proletariat content by promising rewards in the afterlife rather than in this life. Just in case you're not familiar with Marx's thought and vocabulary, bourgeoisie are the well-off people, the people with clout, and the proletariat are the working people, in Marx's view also mostly the good people. And so you're trying to keep them down, and religion functions to do that. Marx said, "Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the feeling of a heartless world, and the soul of a soulless circumstances. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is the demand for their real happiness. So he said, religion is a cry of oppressed people, and to that degree, there's something legit about it, but unfortunately, it gives them a false consciousness that someday they're going to be happy. And so they're willing to delay their happiness now for some future happiness. And religion keeps them from addressing the present situation, which is the only real situation there is. There is no happiness in the eternal future. And so he says we got to get rid of religion so that people can demand their real happiness. Marx thought the proletariat, that is, the working class, would have to throw off religion and its deceit about other worldly rewards in order to rise up against the bourgeoisie and gain control of the means of production so they could gain this worldly rewards. The social conflict approach says that religion maintains social inequality by providing a worldview that justifies oppression. Marx's approach to sociology was critical in the sense that it advocated change in contrast to knowledge for knowledge's sake. Because criticism of the system in place when he was writing was inherent in Marx's approach, he took a particular stand on the existence of religion, namely, that it should be done away with. That is indeed the case. Remember earlier when we heard that sociology was to be objective and doesn't deal with what right or wrong? Marx did not take that approach. Marx said economic oppression is wrong and we need to stop it. And religion is helping oppression, and it's dulling the suffering poor to their plight, the working poor. Get rid of religion and listen to me, and your life is going to get better. And so the social conflict approach explains religion in that way. Marx declared the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. So Marx's sociology didn't aim for unbiased, accurate description of reality. His sociology aimed to change the world. It's worth noting that Marxist changes, the two main changes, rejection of religion and abolition of private property, have always brought disaster. Communist societies that were officially atheistic and that allowed nobody to own anything have brought horrible poverty, persecution, and so whatever we think of Marx, the impact of Marx when it's been attempted to be implemented has been disastrous. He was not just theorizing, he was trying to change the world, but you don't have to like his changes. Another way of explaining religion is offered by Peter Berger, the social constructionist view. Peter Berger said, religion is the human enterprise by which a sacred cosmos is established. Use of the word sacred in this context refers to a quality of mysterious and awesome power other than man and yet related to him, which is believed to reside in certain objects of experience. So religion is socially constructed within a society and it projects things onto that cosmic screen. But Berger is someone who also himself is a believer to some degree. So he nonetheless believes that there's a social construction of the way we think and even of the way we worship and regarding a sacred reality in which we live. The reality of the Christian world, he said, depends on the presence of social structures within which this reality is taken for granted and within which successive generations of individuals are socialized in such a way that this world will be real to them. Berger did not believe that religion is the only kind of knowledge that's socially constructed. He believed that everything that we think about is shaped by our social reality. And in a sense, he's correct about that. Most of us who are Christians come to know about God in a social setting, the preaching of the gospel in the church. We come to know what it is to live for the Lord in the context of other people who are Christian. So this is, in some degree, true, that we live within a social plausibility structure within which some things seem true to us and other things seem false to us without us even consciously thinking about it at times. When this plausibility structure loses its intactness or continuity, the Christian world begins to totter and its reality ceases to impose itself as self-evident truth. Remember what was said about church as sociology defines it, an institution that dominates all of society. So the medieval church, many people didn't even think about atheism or think about other religions very much because Christianity was the only choice on the menu, and everybody thought a certain way or talked a certain way, or at least that's the way sociologists look back upon those times. But when that unity begins to break up, then it's not so plausible that there are other possibilities that could be true. And so whatever plausibility structure you inhabit, the society that you live in makes some things seem certain, other things seem impossible, but when your society changes, then the impossibilities and the certainties get switched around sometimes. In short, plausibility structures are the societal elements that provide the support for a set of beliefs, not necessarily religious beliefs, but beliefs in general, including people, institutions, and processes by which beliefs are spread, that is, socialization. So again, as I pointed out, Berger's ideas about plausibility structure apply to beliefs of every kind, not just religious ones. Our social setting shapes our beliefs. In fact, I have an entire talk about that. In other words, in certain societies, every component of society functions to reinforce the belief system. An example of this may be Iran, where everything is structured to reinforce the Islamic faith as reality. That's probably not as true today, because even in Iran, when official powers are saying this is the way it is, and when government structures are running it that way, electronic communication and the internet have given people, even in Iran, access to many different ways of thinking. Another example might be medieval Christendom, where all people and social structures were assumed to be Christian. And oftentimes when Berger uses the idea of plausibility structures, he has that as his backdrop, Christendom, or when everybody was assumed to be Christian. Religious pluralism is another approach to what stimulates religion. And religious pluralism is a theory of religion that says religion doesn't thrive so much when only one religion has say and absolute domination and power, but when there's some competition. That's when religion really takes off, is when there's multiple options. Religious pluralism is the belief that one can overcome religious differences between different religions and denominational conflicts within the same religion. That's according to the textbook. For most religious traditions, religious pluralism is based on a non-literal view of one's religious traditions, allowing for respect between different traditions on core principles. I'm afraid the textbook is falling into some confusion here, and I'll explain what I mean. Here they say it's perhaps summarized as an attitude which rejects focus on immaterial differences and instead gives respect to those beliefs held in common. Well, that raises the question, which beliefs are immaterial? Is Hinduism correct that widows should be burned? Religions that had child sacrifice, are those differences immaterial? Well, this type of religious pluralism assumes that all differences are immaterial. Do you worship Jesus as God? Or do you say that he was a lunatic? Are those differences immaterial? Obviously, this kind of religious pluralism is impossible. You have to take a position on some things. But religious pluralism as a theory in sociology is misdefined by the textbook here. It's saying religious pluralism is just acceptance of all religions. But as a theory in sociology, pluralism, or a competition view of religions, says that religions thrive when there are options and people have a choice, and then when religions have to tailor themselves to meet the needs of people. The view that's taken here, that religious pluralism in general is a nice thing that all religions just appreciate and like each other and all point to the same reality and point to the same divine being, this assumes that all religions point to the same reality, that they're symbolically true, but not literally true. Well, all religions are true only if all religions are false. You see what I mean? Again, if Jesus is the Son of God, then any religion that says he isn't is a false religion. If Jesus isn't the Son of God, then whatever the case is with other religions, Christianity is false. So, with religious pluralism, the real accurate truth isn't in this religion or that religion or another religion. It's in the doctrine of religious pluralism itself. Literally, they would have to say Christianity is false because Christianity claims Jesus is the only way to God. And that's a false claim according to pluralism. But symbolically, it's inching towards and aiming towards something. And Islam is aiming towards something, even though it denies the Trinity or denies that Jesus is the Son of God. Islam is aiming at the same thing. Now, if you ask a real Muslim, do you believe the same things Christians do? They say, of course not! If you ask a real Christian, do you believe that Jesus is only a prophet and not God, as Islam claims? A Christian will say, of course not! But religious pluralism says, they all believe the same thing. Well, they don't. But religious pluralism says, even though they don't realize they believe the same thing, they believe the same thing. And, as I say, that approach, all religions are true, works only if all religions are false as fact and true only in some figurative and vague form. The existence of religious pluralism depends on the existence of freedom of religion. Freedom of religion is when different religions of a particular region possess the same rights of worship and public expression. Freedom of religion is consequently weakened when one religion is given rights or privileges denied to others, or when all religions are forbidden. So there's no religious freedom if one religion dominates, and obviously there's no religious freedom if all religions are outlawed, as was the case under many communist regimes. So let me just clarify what I've been saying. There's two different meanings for the phrase religious pluralism. One meaning is government should defend religious freedom, allowing various religions rather than forcing one on everyone or none on everyone, as in the case of atheism. A different definition of religious pluralism is this: all religions are equally true, helpful, and similar at their core. So all are false in some of their doctrinal and moral claims because you can't fit all of those together. You see, the one meaning is good. Government power should not force matters of the soul so that everybody has to believe God against their will. God sways the will by the power and preaching of the gospel, not by the power of the sword. So, in that sense, I believe in religious pluralism. Government should allow different people to pursue different ways of believing because Christianity is spread by the power of truth, not by the power of violence. But the claim that all religions are equally true is bunk. The fact that all our knowledge is limited shouldn't be used to disallow statements of what we can know, as we're able to make. So Leslie Newbegin, the person who said this, says, hey, yeah, our knowledge is limited. And so pluralism trades on that to say nobody knows the whole truth. Well, yeah, nobody knows the whole truth, but some of us know some of the truth. He says, the unknown God is a convenient object of belief, since its character is a matter for me to decide. It can't challenge me. He's right on there. We like this vague uncertainty because I get to make it up as I go in that case. Religious pluralism has been argued to be a factor in the continued existence of religion in the U.S. Now they're getting to the actual sociological definition used by some scholars of sociology of religion. This theoretical approach proposes that because no religion was guaranteed a monopoly in the U.S., religious pluralism led to the conversion of religions in the U.S. into capitalist organizations. Now here again, they're getting very prejudicial because a lot of the theorists don't put it quite that way. A lot of the theorists will say that religion is stronger in the U.S. than in Europe exactly because there were state churches and you were forced to be a Christian in Europe. And so when that weakened, a lot of people said, I've had it with that, and they never did believe in the first place. Whereas in the U.S. there was religious freedom, and so there were many different varieties, especially different varieties of Christianity, which held to many of the same core beliefs. But they were allowed to flourish on their own, and so while religion faded badly in Europe after the state churches lost their power, religion continued to be very vibrant in the U.S. because there were these different understandings of the Bible, but all pointing to the same Savior who was God. Again, the sociologists don't put it that way. They just said religious pluralism led to competition and variety. And then some of the theorists, especially the left-wing ones, want to say, well, it's just like one of those miserable capitalist organizations. We don't like capitalism, and we don't like Christianity or religious competition either. As a result, according to the textbook, religions are now better understood as capitalist corporations peddling their wares in a highly competitive market than they are as monopolistic churches like Roman Catholicism was prior to the Reformation, or some might argue still is in Latin America, or as small fervent protest-like sects are. So they're saying that religion is to be understood in terms of free enterprise. Now, again, I've already criticized this view somewhat, but there's some truth in it. We got to admit it, that some religions and many Christians are acting like CEOs. They're looking for the best advertising techniques. They're trying to do surveys of what people are looking for, and then they're going to provide it. They're going to provide those wares, and some churches are very much into marketing, providing a product, and not looking so much to what the truth is that God reveals, so much as, hey, what do people want lately? What do they want their worship to be like? What do they want their set of beliefs to be like? Let's give it to them. They're good businessmen. The customer is king. And so while we might disagree or differ with the sociologists in some respects, they do have their finger on something that is very significant here. The result of religious pluralism is, like capitalism generally in the U.S., a consumer attitude. People consume religion like they do other goods. Because religions are good at marketing themselves as the providers of social psychological compensators, they've been successful. So this is how this brand of sociology explains it. Religion thrives if the people providing religion are good marketers and try to meet the demand. The social psychological theory of religion has another explanation. They say the reason religion continues to exist is because it answers tough questions, pressing questions that are difficult, if not impossible, to address scientifically. Well, there's a lot of things that can't be addressed scientifically, and I won't touch too much on the relationship between science and religion here. Let me just say that there again, they're going with an old, worn-out view that science is way over here, and religion is way over here. Facts are here. Unverifiable wishes are over here. But anyway, science can't address the question of what happens when someone dies other than to provide a biological explanation. Yeah, science says, hey, the heart stops, the brain stops functioning, you're dead. They can't tell you if there's a you beyond that that survives the death of the body. Science is also unable to address the question of a higher purpose in life other than simply to reproduce or exist. And finally, science cannot disprove or prove the existence of a higher being. So here, the textbook is being somewhat modest and saying there's a lot that science really can't answer, and religion does answer some of those things. Whether or not the answers are true can't be verified scientifically. One of the keys to high subjective well-being or happiness, you know, high subjective well-being is a fancy word for happiness, is a goal or purpose in life. And that brings us to the social psychological theory of religion. For the most positive impact on happiness, subjective well-being, goals have to be difficult but attainable. People have to work towards salvation, but they also have to believe it can be achieved, because if they don't have to work for it, they won't do anything. And if it can't be achieved, well, then why work for it? And thus, religion can provide a goal and purpose in life for people who believe they need one. Now, those of us who are Christians may read this and say, oh, come on, I'm not a Christian because I'm working for my salvation. But let's face it, an awful lot of religion, in fact, most of the religions of the world, would fit this description. They tell you, okay, You want to be saved? You want to live forever? Or you want to get out of this particular problem? Here's steps A, B, and C, or here's the code of ethics that you must follow. And if you're good enough, then God will accept you, or you can achieve the nirvana you were hoping for, or whatever it is that you're after. So most religions are a self-help thing. They tell you what you can do to get your salvation, and they make it tough, but not impossible. And hey, that kind of religion appeals to people. It's not true, but it appeals to people, and a lot of people adopt religions like that. Christianity says you can't save yourself, but God has done what is necessary to save you, and accept what Jesus has done for you and gives you by faith, and then live for Him in thankfulness, not trying to work towards your salvation. You're working out of your salvation. You're working out of the energy and love and power that God has freely given you. Belief in God is attributable to a combination of the above factors. God's existence alleviates fear of death and provides meaning, but it's also informed by a discussion of socialization. So here you've got the social psychological explanation that's drawing on parts of the other explanations. And keep in mind, sometimes things aren't just explained, they're explained away. And oftentimes, too often, sociologists try to not just explain religion, but explain it away. Anyway, the biggest predictor of adult religiosity is parental religiosity. If a person's parents were religious when he was a child, he's likely to be religious when he grows up. Children are socialized into religion by their parents and their peers, and as a result, they tend to stay in religions. And alternatively, children raised in secular homes tend not to convert to religion. So again, sociology isn't telling you what happens all the time. It's saying most of the time you're going to take after your parents. That's not just true in religion. It's true in many different aspects of life. And in fact, it's the way God designed. God designed family to be the primary transmitter of values, of truth, of being pleasing to God. And just because people veer off in a different direction doesn't change the basic structure that family is the primary transmitter of belief and of what is important to people. And if parents fail, their children are likely to be in the darkness as well, unless somebody else comes along and teaches them. So parental socialization, as the theorists point out, is very, very important. The Bible itself says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. That's not a guarantee. It's a sociological generalization. What they start with young under their parents is what they're likely to be like when they grow up, unless other factors intervene. So we've been looking at these various theories of socialization, the social psychological. You combine these three social psychological components. They are supposed to explain, with the help of religious pluralism, the continued high levels of religiosity in the U.S. and elsewhere. People are afraid of things they don't understand. They feel a need or a purpose in life to be happy. And they're socialized into religion and believing in God or gods by their parents. Now, there's no denying that these are factors. Sometimes people want to address their fears. On the other hand, the reality of God introduces new fears. Okay? A lot of atheists believe in atheism because they don't want to think about what comes after death. They want to think, when I die, I'm done, and I can do whatever I want in life. So, let's face it, religion isn't the only thing where people's beliefs are sometimes motivated by what they don't understand or by what they fear. And people's sense of purpose, too. Many an atheist has got a lot of sense of purpose by saying, I'm going to rescue other people from their belief in these false things. Look at what drove Marx. Marx wanted to save people from the opiate of the people. He didn't want people to be drugged up by religion. He wanted to set them free. He felt they should have their true purpose in life. And he wanted societies, and the communists wanted societies and schools where God wasn't even mentioned, so they could socialize people into being atheists. The interesting thing is that even in those atheist societies, a lot of people ended up not being atheists because, well, God is there. And people have those inner longings and that reality of God beckoning them no matter how they've been socialized. But a particular form of socialization can misdirect that yearning for God into the worship of false gods or idols, or into suppressing that longing for God. So those are the theories of religion: the structural functional, the social conflict of Marx, the social constructionist, the religious pluralism notion that there's competition and pleasing the customer, and the social psychological view that religion meets felt needs. And there's a grain of truth in all of them, quite a bit of truth in some of them, and certainly not the complete truth in any of them, because the real reason that religion exists is that God exists, and our hearts are restless until they rest in Him. As the Bible says, you have put eternity in the human heart. And because that eternity, that longing is there, most people in most societies are going to be religious in one form or another. And God and His reality are evident in the things that He has made outside of us, as well as in the way that He created us. And so, study what the sociologists say about religion, learn something from it, and realize that there is more to it than just that.